4:06. You're listening to Central Time here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up in Wisconsin Life, we'll be talking about fun and kid-friendly outdoor activities to enjoy in our state this summer.
First, Governor Walker spent most of last week in Israel. After returning home on Thursday, he headed to Iowa on Saturday. During the past few months, he's been traveling the country and abroad in the run-up to a likely presidential bid.
Some critics say that he's traveling too much and not spending enough time in Wisconsin. The state Democratic Party even put up billboards in Green Bay and Milwaukee calling on the governor to, quote, come home and get to work for Wisconsin.
Walker responded by saying that the Democrats criticizing him are hypocritical because they supported 14 state senators who left the state to prevent voting on Act 10, and he says he's fully engaged with the state.
PolitiFact Wisconsin recently took a look at the data to figure out exactly how much time Governor Walker has been spending in the state since the beginning of the year. Tom Kircher, PolitiFact Wisconsin reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, joins us now. Tom, welcome to Central Time.
Good to be with you. Thanks.
So first of all, this must be a little tricky to piece together exactly how much time Governor Walker has spent in the state. How did you do it?
That's a good point to start with. There's not one comprehensive record to document where the governor spends, you know, every bit of his time. So what we did was try to measure it in two different ways. We took a look at how many nights he spends in Wisconsin, and then how many days he spent in other states.
And once you've got those numbers, based on what you have, do you have an idea about how much is a lot of time away or a lot of time in the state? How do you gauge what you got?
We did. We found that with both measures, he's in the state roughly half the time and out of state roughly half. So on the first measure, when we took a look at the number of nights he was spending in Wisconsin, those records are available only for January through March. And what we found is that just about half the time it was documented that he spent the night either at the governor's mansion in Madison or at his home in Wauwatosa. And then the second way we did the measures was to take a look at news reports and other accounts of his travels out of state and out of the country. And there again, we found that just under half the time he had spent at least part of a day outside of Wisconsin.
And let's look at those numbers more particularly, numbers of nights spent in Wisconsin at the mansion, at his home, or out of the state. No location listed. What did you find in January, February, and March?
Right. He spent about 14 nights per month.
And I think that we may have lost Tom Kircher. Tom, are you with us? Well, we'll work on getting him back on the line as we take a closer look about how much time Governor Walker has been spending in the state of Wisconsin and out of the state of Wisconsin. This in the run-up for a likely presidential bid. There are critics of the governor saying he should be spending more time in Wisconsin. He's spending too much time looking at his credentials as a presidential candidate, not enough time in the state. Others saying, you know, he's doing all right and he's taking care of Wisconsin. Tom, are you back with us?
I am.
Great. We were talking about the number of days that the governor spent in Wisconsin, and you said about half, looks like, in Wisconsin. Is that the average for the 3 months you looked at?
Yeah, that's right, from January through March. And again, we're relying there on the official calendars produced by the governor's office. So on many of the nights, they indicate specifically he was at the governor's mansion in Madison, or on other nights, he may have been at his home in Wauwatosa. On many other days, however, there was really no specific notation. So I think you're safe to say that roughly half, at least half of the time, he was spending the night in Wisconsin.
One interesting number, in March of 2015, you have the number of days overnight at the mansion as 9 and the number of days with no overnight location listed, meaning it's likely that he is traveling out of the country, perhaps, at 22. Mm-hmm. That's a bigger one.
Yeah, that frankly, it's difficult to know, to draw too much from that. Is that a case of where he's traveling quite a bit more, or is that, you know, some fault of record keeping? If you take a look at some of the other numbers, for example, in that story, we indicated that in March, where it looked like he was spending lots of nights somewhere else, we showed him as being in other states on 12 days that month. So certainly plenty of travel on some instances. In other cases, it's hard to know, again, exactly where he may have spent overnight in the state or somewhere else.
We're talking to Tom Kircher right now, PolitiFact Wisconsin reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, about the amount of time that Governor Walker is spending in and outside of Wisconsin, given comments from critics that he may be traveling too much. And looking at outside of Wisconsin days, now these are, it looks like, domestic travel days here in the country. What have you found there about where he's been?
You know, he's been to 17 different states, as well as making a number of trips to the District of Columbia. When you think about the 17 states, you might imagine Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, some of the early voting and early caucus states, and that's true. He's made actually more than a dozen appearances in those three states, but you know, quite a bit of range as well, to New York City more than once, out to California, down to Florida. He's covered quite a bit of the country.
Any idea how that might compare to other likely candidates or candidates? Chris Christie, for example, Bobby Jindal, is he in the ballpark there?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. We limited our analysis to looking at Governor Walker's travels, but we did note in the story that the other two governors you mentioned, Republican governors, Jindal in Louisiana and Christie in New Jersey, in similar positions in the sense they're active governors and also considering a run. And we noted that they've been under criticism as well for how do you strike the balance, how much time is appropriate to spend in your state doing your governing versus, you know, how much travel do you have to do if you want to make a serious run for the White House.
And how has the governor responded to criticism, especially from Democrats that say he's spending too much time out of Wisconsin?
Yeah, it's interesting. It seems certainly a legitimate question to raise. A guy who runs for governor, he's elected to run the state, and he's gone a lot. So it's natural to say, gee, how much are you here? How much are you really engaged? At the same time, there's maybe some irony in that criticism. I mean, a lot of the Democrats, since Walker has been governor, have been highly critical of his policies. So it's interesting that they would say, gee, you need to be here more, doing even more work on the state's business when they've been so critical of them. But certainly it's a legitimate question to raise, particularly as, you know, he continues to do so well in polling in some of those key states, Iowa, New Hampshire, as well as in some of the national polls. You've got to expect that the travel is going to continue, if not increase.
And what about from Republicans? Has there been any feedback in either direction about how Republicans are feeling about the governor clearly working on what looks to be a presidential bid?
Yeah, if there is that, I don't think that that's surfaced nearly as much. I mean, there's no question we're in a key time in terms of the state budget. That's something the governor introduces in February. The legislature works on in detail, usually into June. And while it's in the legislature's court, so to speak, right now, you would expect that since the state budget is one of the most important tasks for the governor, that he would be pretty fully engaged. And, you know, he's not. He's made statements to the effect that, look, yes, I'm traveling a lot, but I'm in touch frequently. I'm maybe even more focused in my efforts since I'm away a little bit more. But there's certainly not, I don't think you could make the case that it's the same to be in touch by phone or whatnot as opposed to being there in person, you know, pushing hard for your priorities.
Tom, thanks for joining us.
You bet.
We've been talking to Tom Kircher, PolitiFact reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, about the amount of time that Governor Walker is spending in and outside of Wisconsin, given some comments from critics that he's traveling too much.
It's time for Wisconsin Life. The landscape of childhood covers everything from playgrounds and vacant lots to woods and parks. Mike Paulus tells us about finding his roots in a wide open space in Eau Claire.
I grew up on Eau Claire's west side, across the street from a big empty lot. The lot was covered by a crop of tall grass, and it had a few small pockets of woods and an old dead tree just lying on its side out in the middle, all by itself. It hadn't been cut down. It just got old and died. That field, it belonged to me and my friends. It was ours. We had secret hideouts and trails. We had shortcuts and battlegrounds. We had a different set of games for every square foot of that field, because we owned it. That old fallen tree I mentioned was pretty big. Beaten smooth by years of wind and rain, we could straddle it like a horse, but we didn't play cowboys and Indians. The Lone Ranger enjoyed a brief resurgence in the early 80s, and my parents bought me some of the toys, but the Masked Man could never hold his ground against Darth Vader. That big log was the Millennium Falcon more often than not, and we had scrambled across the field as stormtroopers blasted laser bolts past our ears, yelling, "We gotta get off this planet! Run!" Then we'd hop on to the old dead tree and argue over who got to punch the imaginary hyperdrive button. And sometimes, one of us would, "Oh no!" fall overboard during takeoff, forcing a dangerous high-speed rescue. Eventually, we all learned to ride our bikes, and that big dead log just seemed kind of slow. But back then, in the summertime, even the rain couldn't stop us. We had tromped through the field, our pant legs getting soaked, our butts getting dirty, our boots glooping into islands of mud as we waded through a sea of weeds. Have you ever just bent over and grabbed a big clump of grass with both hands just to, I don't know, pull on it? I used to do that all the time. After the rain stopped, if the field was mucky enough, I could grab a bunch of weeds and slowly drag their root system up out of the ground with a satisfying thwerp. I'd feel like He-Man, master of the universe. But if the roots were stubborn, refusing to be ripped from their sockets, I'd lean back on my heels and feel the heft of my body hanging there like a little counterweight. Seconds ago, this grass was a meaningless clump of deadish plant matter. But now, feeling how fused it was to planet Earth, it meant everything. I had absolutely no doubt about this. If the world was suddenly flipped upside down, I knew the weeds could hold me. I could just hang there, grasping onto that clump of grass as my feet dangled toward empty space, the clouds chugging along far below. If my little kid hands were just strong enough to hold on, I'd be safe. And everything else would just tumble down into the hazy, blue, summertime sky.
Mike Paulus is the online editor of Volume 1 in Eau Claire. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. For more information, visit wisconsinlife.org.
Summer is approaching. School will be out soon, which means there will be lots of opportunities to pull the kids away from their electronic devices and into Wisconsin's great outdoors. Here to give us some ideas for fun, kid-friendly outdoor activities is Lisa Marshall, Communications Director for the Wisconsin Department of Tourism. Lisa, thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. I love your show. I'm listening to it on the car right now.
Oh, wonderful. Well, we just heard about a great outdoor activity for Mike Paulus of Eau Claire, and that one's free. So I want to start, what are some great things to do outside with the family that don't cost anything?
Well, one of the things is fishing. And, you know, if you are new to fishing or your kids are new, you might want to take advantage of Free Fishing Weekend. It's the first weekend of June 5th, 6th, and 7th. And a lot of the state parks are going to offer you free equipment and seminars to learn all about fishing. So that's one way to get your kids away from the electronic devices. That same weekend, we have State Parks Open House, which means you can get into all of the state parks for free without a vehicle admission sticker. And some fun things, they're doing all kinds of fun things at the state parks. One of them at the Kettle Moraine State Forest, they have an event called Cash In, Cash Out. And so it's a geocaching event, and they're going to give away prizes. And at the same time, they're cleaning up the park. So it's actually cash in, trash out, to get the term correct there. But that's another fun way. And then we have tons of great bicycle trails. It doesn't cost much to get a state bike trail pass. And then Consumer County Parks. Most of those are free to get into, and a lot of the county park land is right up against a state park. Like, for example, in Door County, Cave Point Park, it's a county park. It's right next to Whitefish Dune State Park.
All right, and let's move on to art festivals. Oh, we've got a ton of them here in the state. Can you give us a little sneak preview of some of the art festivals we're going to want to check out this summer?
Well, we got 100 throughout the state. In fact, we have a guide that you can either download or order off of travelwisconsin.com that has all of these festivals. But there's two big ones. And one of them, of course, is the Art Fair in the Square in Madison, and that's in July. And the reason it's so big is they'll have 500 juried artists at that one. And then another 140 Wisconsin artists off the square. And then the other big one is the Lakefront Festival of Arts, and that's in Milwaukee. It's put on by the Milwaukee Art Museum, and it's 3 days, and it's right there on the lovely lakefront of Lake Michigan.
Can you make a case for this as a family outing? I know sometimes I get resistance from the kids to go to an art fair. Is there a lot of stuff going on apart from looking at the arts and crafts for sale?
Well, you know, from experience, I can tell you about the one here on the square is that they have a lot of live entertainment and some kids' activities. And I know the one corner, I think it's, I'm not sure which corner of the Capitol, but they have, you know, different dance groups performing, and actually kids from local dance schools will be, you know, doing performances. So, yeah, there's a lot to see and hear besides just, you know, walking around looking at the art.
All right, let's hit, you mentioned county parks. Let's look at the state parks now. Some kid-friendly highlights that we shouldn't miss.
Well, my favorite, I'm just going to go with my favorite, is Devil's Lake State Park. And I can hear
that. That's too easy. No, go ahead.
All right. No, I know it's so easy, but I can speak from experience. I've taken an eight-year-old up there. And it's, you know, it's challenging. You know, it's not too challenging. They can't get up to the bluffs. And, you know, you got those rock formations. And what kid does not want to see Devil's Doorway or, you know, Standing Rock and get their picture next to that? So I think those make it really fun. But I mean, besides that, is we have a lot of really great waterfalls. And I think that's like another, to get a kid interested in going to a state park, what can I see? There's a goal. You get to the waterfall, and there's some amazing ones up in northern Wisconsin. Amicon Falls State Park, Copper Falls State Park, and Patterson State Park has the Big Manitou Falls, 165 feet. It's Wisconsin's highest. So again, you give your child a goal, you get to the waterfall, get a great selfie, and have a great afternoon.
We're talking to Lisa Marshall from the Wisconsin Department of Tourism. She's helping us plan our summer itinerary for family-friendly outdoor fun. So something to get the kids off the couch, off the screen, and into the outdoors. How about, let's say we want to stay the night out there, do some hiking and camping. Give us some highlights to look forward to there.
All right. Well, I'm going to here's one for you, is camping on one of the islands of the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore. And, I mean, there's a couple ways you can do that. You can, if you got older teens, maybe you can actually kayak with your gear out to these remote islands and then, you know, pitch a camp that way. The ferry service up there will also drop you off. So this is kind of more remote camping, and I would say, you know, for your more experienced camper. Another fun thing you can do is go down the lower Wisconsin Riverway and camp on a sandbar. I mean, how cool is that? You can pitch a tent on a sandbar. So it's just kind of looking at it from a different point of view or a different kind of, you know, environment. Let's see, another one, just consider our private campgrounds as well. We have many throughout the state and great amenities. So if you have a child that needs amenities and, you know, skate parks or a pool or, you know, just group activities or campfires at the end of the day, I think our private campground network is fantastic.
Lisa, earlier I mentioned the kid as the obstacle in my family. It's the adults. Well, or this adult is the obstacle. Make the case that I should, you know, borrow somebody's tent and do some camping, because it's kind of, I don't know, it's kind of an alien concept for me, I'll admit.
Well, here's the deal. There's camping light, too. I mean, there's a lot of places. There's things called camper cabins. They're like not quite camping, not quite a cabin. It's sort of in between. So if you're not someone that wants to pitch a tent and sleep on the ground, you know, there's other options. You know, there's more cabin-like camping. And I think it's just being in this kind of environment gets you away from, you know, TV and iPads and iPhones, and, you know, you're under the stars, and what kid doesn't want to, like, build a bonfire and cook s'mores and just have family time, play games? I think that it's a very good opportunity for family bonding.
Now, I am a history fan, and I will admit I think I haven't done enough historical tourism in Wisconsin. Any good outdoor sites I should check out this summer?
Well, obviously Old World Wisconsin and Eagle is certainly our biggest, you know, outdoor history museum. In fact, it's one of the largest in the country, that, you know, depicting rural life in the 19th century. And, you know, they make it fun. It's very interactive. Their staff remain in character the entire time. They do a lot of fun events. They'll have, like, 19th century baseball or, you know, Little House on the Prairie Day. So they do a lot of really fun interactive events to make history, bring it to life for the kids. But a couple other ones, Circus World And Baraboo is another good one in terms of telling you the circus history, but then, of course, there's always the entertainment aspect of it. They actually have circus and, you know, different things you can watch that make it interactive for the kids. If you got a child that's into trains, then you might want to try the National Railroad Museum in Green Bay. They've got one of the world's largest steam locomotives on display there. And then they also have Heritage Hill in Green Bay. So you can kind of do two different kinds of historic activities and then go over to Bay Beach and ride the rides. So you can kind of mix it up, historic, and then go have some fun.
Lisa, as we wrap up, can you give us a resource to help us do homework, find more info?
Yeah, I would go to travelwisconsin.com. It's the state's largest resource for travel information in the state. We've got events, we've got places to stay, things to do, and a lot of great articles. You know, you could search kid-friendly, and you're going to come out with many ideas to give you some thoughts for the summer.
Lisa, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure, Rob. Thanks for having me.
That was Lisa Marshall from the Wisconsin Department of Tourism giving us some great ideas for summer fun in Wisconsin. Head into any grocery store today and you'll definitely notice a growing trend. There are more products than ever on store shelves with the words gluten-free on the box.
Gluten-free food is no longer just for people with celiac disease. More and more people are making the conscious decision to cut gluten out of their diets, labeling it as public enemy number one when it comes to nutritional health.
Here with us now to separate fact from fiction in the gluten debate is Stephen Yaffa. He's the author of Grain of Truth, The Real Case for and Against Wheat and Gluten. Stephen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, my pleasure.
Well, let's back up for a sec. A few years back, the section of the store with gluten-free products was maybe a tiny little area in the back. Maybe it didn't exist at all, depending on where you are. Now they're all over the place. A lot of restaurants offering gluten-free alternatives front and center. You say at no time in our history has a major food staple endured such widespread public distrust as wheat. So how do we get here?
You know, we got here through a combination of things that are understood and the mysteries that always surround a fad. You know, it goes viral in some ways, and next thing you know, it's spreading in all directions. This one got here for a combination of celebrities bolstering it, like Gwyneth Paltrow, with sports figures sort of kicking in, and a few others as well. And it really sort of came out of the Atkins low-carb diet of the 80s and 90s and mushroomed into something somewhat related to it, which is obviously the carbs that are in white flour, and then more specifically gluten, which are a combination of two proteins in the white flour, the interior of the seed, which gives us the white flour. So there's no simple, easy answer, but once it caught on, it sort of crossed the boundaries from being about possibly issues having to do with digestion to kind of becoming now a kind of a social cachet for being attending to your health and feeling in some ways perhaps you might even be somewhat superior to somebody who isn't paying as much attention to being gluten-free as you are. So it's hard to tell, you know, where it's going to go, but those are kind of the ingredients that led to where we are now.
And how much of an economic powerhouse is gluten-free right now, ballpark?
Good question. It's estimated to be $16 billion a year.
All right. Well, I want to listen to a clip from the movie This Is the End. Seth Rogen, playing himself, is explaining why he's gone gluten-free but isn't quite clear on what gluten is.
Great.
Gluten's a vague term. It's something that's used to categorize things that are bad. You know, calories, that's a gluten. Fat, that's a gluten.
Somebody just told you you probably shouldn't eat gluten. You're like, oh, I guess I shouldn't eat gluten.
So you started to touch on it there, Stephen. What exactly is gluten? What does it do in our bread and in our diet?
I'll tell you exactly what it does. And by the way, Seth's not alone. Most people who turn out to be staying off gluten really don't know what it is. It's actually protein. It has nothing at all to do with most things that immediately create a wheat belly at all. It's really what gives the bread its dome shape when it rises in the oven, because one of the proteins creates kind of an elastic quality. The other is extensible, and the final result of that is that you get air bubbles that are trapped in bread escaping carbon dioxide, and those are the air bubbles in the bread that create the rise.
So it's what makes bread bready and fluffy. And
exactly. When you make bread out of things that are not wheat, that don't have gluten in them, you don't get those results. So really nobody's come along with any kind of substitute in terms of the crunchy, wonderful, delicious, chewy qualities in wheat bread that that really satisfy those particular characteristics.
Now, the concern over gluten, some people have celiac disease, which is bad, and they should, I think everybody agrees on this one, avoid gluten. But there's a lot of other people who have or think they have gluten sensitivity, and that's more of a gray area. Can you talk about this idea of gluten sensitivity?
Yes, it is a gray area, and in fact, after all of the stuff that's gone on, it still remains quite mysterious, really, in terms of being, the stuff that you can easily diagnose medically. You can't go in and get a blood test for it, for example. You might, see slight elevation in some of the biomarkers, but really it's still unknown. Essentially, gluten sensitivity really sort of taps into areas that are somewhat related to celiac disease, but not the severe autoimmune reaction that gluten can cause. It basically, when people have a problem with it, one way or another, it's usually because of the inflammatory nature of those proteins as they get into the bloodstream, and they can cause joint aches, fatigue, and bloating, which are the three most common, really the most common aspects that people relate to being gluten-free. And one of the complications is that bloating in particular may have nothing at all to do with gluten. There are potentially carbs that don't completely ferment in your small intestine, and when they start to ferment in your large intestine, they cause issues that maybe people think of as being related to gluten, but they're not.
Talking to Stephen Yaffa, author of the book Grain of Truth, The Real Case For and Against Wheat and Gluten. And Stephen, on that point, I think there are a lot of people out there, we'll probably hear from some of them when we invite calls in a little bit at 800-642-1234, who'll say, I don't have celiac, I wasn't diagnosed with it, but I gave up gluten and I feel better in a lot of ways. So is this just placebo effect, or is there maybe a side benefit that isn't about the gluten?
I think, of course I've heard this a lot in the 2 years that I've been doing this book, as you might imagine. And I would never, dispute that at all. But yes, gluten often is really not the culprit here. What happens is if you give up gluten, and I'm sure a lot of these people know this from their personal experience, you have to give up a lot of processed foods that you are eating, foods with refined white flour in them. You know, I have major issues to take up with the authors of Wheat Belly and Grain Brain because they're really not telling us the whole story. But I certainly agree with them in terms of the damage that can be done by pure carbohydrates that are shooting right into your bloodstream. So if you're giving up that, and you're giving up other processed foods that may have gluten in it, you're doing yourself a lot of good by eating real foods instead. And I think that has a lot to do with it. And really, I'm not the final judge here. The doctors in this country who are the leaders of this in the celiac realm, the first thing they say is essentially their version of what I just said, which is that you can't really go gluten-free without reverting in a good way to eating real foods.
But you're making the case that we can eat real foods without going gluten-free, and I want to pursue that point a little. You talk about how we make a lot of our bread in this country. We really beat the heck out of our wheat or other grains in doing it. We lose a lot of the benefit of it. So what's wrong, as you see it, with the way we make a lot of our bread in this country?
Good question. We do beat the heck out of it. What we do is short ferment it, and that means from beginning to end in an industrial baker, you're going from dough through bread through shipping it out the door. So that 4 hour short fermentation does nothing at all to reduce the potential toxicity of the gluten molecules. But if you're doing it in what's considered to be the real way, meaning the natural way, over 2 days, long fermentation or sometimes called slow rise, you wind up with sourdough breads that may be tangy or may not be, depending on how much acetic acid they have in them, but they all have lactic acid, and that's extremely good for your probiotics in your gut, and it really cuts through these bulky gluten molecules that look like tangled fishing lines. When you chop them up, they are much easier, chemically, that is, of course, through long fermentation, they're much easier to digest. And an awful lot of people who think they're gluten sensitive find them, to their surprise, that they can eat sourdough breads without any problem.
I want to read a comment from Meredith on Facebook. Meredith writes, I've been gluten-free for 10 years due to gluten intolerance. So for me, gluten is the enemy. Now, due to all the hype surrounding being gluten-free, I'm embarrassed to even admit to anyone that I'm gluten-free due to them right away jumping to the assumption that I'm riding the gluten-free bandwagon. So there is kind of a gluten-free bandwagon. Are a lot of people, you think, Stephen, going gluten-free who just really don't need to?
The best estimate from clinical research with, you know, checking out, I think, 4,000 patients, I mean, a lot of people, is that about 6% of them have symptoms that may be related to gluten sensitivity. On the other hand, 35% of the people in this country, close to 35%, think that they have something, issues with gluten that really is causing them to cut back on their use or to stop using gluten entirely. So there's a huge disproportionate amount of people who are relating their issues to gluten compared to people who really seem to have potentially any kind of issue.
We're talking right now with author Stephen Yaffa. He's presenting the case for and against gluten. His new book is called Grain of Truth. You can join the conversation with your thoughts, your experiences as well, at 800-642-1234.
Did you make the choice to go gluten-free? And if so, why? And have you noticed a difference in your health? If you're a wheat eater, do all these claims against gluten bother you? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking right now with Stephen Yaffa. He's the author of the book Grain of Truth, The Real Case for and Against Wheat and Gluten. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the growing gluten-free trend? Have you embraced it, tried it, been puzzled by it? And what questions do you have about gluten and wheat? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll bring Stephen Yaffa back up in just a few minutes. Coming up after 5, we'll look at President Obama's announcement today banning the use of certain military-style equipment, the sale of military-style equipment to local police departments. That's coming up after 5 after the news. Bringing Stephen Yaffa back on the line with us. Lost him there for a sec. Stephen, do we have you back with us?
We do indeed.
Okay, we're going to go to our callers now, Stephen. We've got Corey on the line in Platteville. Corey, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to thank Stephen very much for writing this book. My wife and her entire family, her grandfather was diagnosed with celiac about 8 or 10 years ago. And overall, for us, it made it really difficult. My wife, growing up, was anemic, and she had a lot of migraines and had a lot of horrible health issues. And when they finally diagnosed her grandfather, she thought, oh, maybe it'll work for me. And it worked great for her. She has no migraines anymore. She's in much better health. But the only way to test for, or one of the ways to test for celiac disease is for them to actually give you a lot of wheat. And, you know, her idea is, why would I want to do that? Because I feel crummy after I do so.
So, Corey, she hasn't been, I just want to double check, she has or hasn't been diagnosed with celiac?
She has not. She has not, because the way to test it is to give a lot of, you know, give them a lot of wheat and then test it.
Corey?
Well, just let me jump in for a second. If she were being tested for celiac disease, I mean, you may know this already, so stop me. You know, that's an inherited disease that has biomarkers on the genes, and that can be tested with a, you know, painlessly with a simple blood test these days.
Oh, so that's a thought for your wife, Corey. Well, good luck to you and to her. Is it, you just said, Stephen, it is inherited or it can be celiac disease?
No, it is inherited. And not everybody who has that particular genetic disposition necessarily gets celiac disease, but there's definitely a propensity toward celiac disease if you have that genetic biomarker.
And Stephen, as you're raising concerns about too many people maybe going gluten-free, you still, you know, people who have celiac, you're hoping will be diagnosed and can behave accordingly, right?
Oh, absolutely. And everything that has to do with celiac disease really does not apply to gluten sensitivity and vice versa in terms of being diagnosed, because you really cannot eat wheat in any form whatsoever if you have celiac disease without initiating an autoimmune reaction, which is really severe. It's really the body attacking itself.
Corey, thanks a lot for the call. Good luck to your wife. Before I go back to callers, Stephen, one thing you point out in your book is that gluten-free has taken on almost evangelical tones among some of its proponents and practitioners. Can you speak to that a little?
I can, for sure. You know, there's a kind of I call it almost a kind of a quasi-religious belief that attaches itself to some fads, and this one for sure, which is essentially that, you know, if we just sort of give our belief to one thing or one person or whatever it might be who's going to solve a lot of our problems for us, it kind of alleviates some of the anxiety that goes about having to, you know, thread through life and keep making complicated decisions about complicated things. So the nature of this fad to some degree taps right into that kind of a true believer syndrome. And I don't attach it necessarily to religion, but I think it stems from a lot of the same impulses that are part of us, you know, just as human nature. It's kind of like the one-stop, one-shop thing that's going to cure us, you know, quickly, and that will solve problems for us without, a lot more invested in trying to figure things out. And it certainly started that way, wheat that is, because Sylvester Graham, who was a reverend, was really the first guy in the 1830s to insist that people eat only whole wheat. And he, in his name, of course, now attaches itself to the Graham cracker. And by the way, the Graham crackers we now eat are nothing like the Graham crackers that Sylvester made back then. They were like a hardtack. They were brittle. They were 100% whole wheat and probably pretty much impossible to get down. But he insisted that they would stop anybody from having any kind of beliefs that related to sexual arousal, which was very important for him because religion and sexuality were really at different ends of the pole as far as he was concerned. They were, you know, one did not... one could not exist with the other.
We're talking about wheat and gluten with Stephen Yaffa, author of the book Grain of Truth. We heard from Peter on Facebook who writes, an argument in favor of going gluten-free is that in order to do so, you pretty much have to stop eating processed foods. Start eating lots of fresh and homemade foods. Gluten-free eliminates many unhealthy foods. Stephen, that's definitely something you're saying in your book, but you also say we can do those things without giving up the gluten.
Yes, I think we can. And I'm not giving medical advice, and everybody's system is really unique, which is one of the issues I have with blanket statements made by William Davis in Wheat Belly, for example, that wheat has killed more people on Earth than all wars combined. My theory about it is very much like the person on Facebook who wrote in, which essentially is if we give up, eating gluten free things that are gluten things that are bad for us and check out real foods made with gluten, I think we're probably on the road to really having a good diet if our systems can handle it. And I think sourdough, to repeat myself briefly, is a way of dealing with gluten and making it compatible with the way that most of us are built. And the only way to find out is to buy an artisanal loaf of whole wheat sourdough, take a little bit of it if you think you might have gluten issues, and see how, you know, how your system reacts to it.
As we see more gluten-free products, you know, are these products just gluten-free, not necessarily any healthier or less processed? Are we kind of sidestepping the problem?
I think they're not only equally as bad for us. I think in many cases they're worse because they have, if you look on the ingredients, you're going to find potato flour, rice flour, tapioca flour, and so forth. This is a lot of empty carbo stuff that really is dreadful. It does nothing for us nutritionally, which is what whole wheat does. 100% whole wheat is very, very healthy, and one of the benefits is fiber, and none of those gluten-free products that I know about really substitutes fairly for the things you miss when you're not eating 100% whole wheat.
Go back to our callers. You've got Terry on the line in Waupaca. Terry, hi.
Hi. I love hearing what your guest has to say. I went gluten-free a year ago, but I did it because I have an autoimmune disease. I do not have celiac. I have Hashimoto's, which is Hashimoto's thyroid. But I found that by going gluten-free, but I didn't go with the gluten-free products. I just dropped processed foods, basically, but gluten-free was a big part of it. And I had lost weight, and I'm also on the road to putting my autoimmune disease in remission. The antibodies that define my disease are steadily decreasing. They were over 500 before I started. They're now under 60.
All right, Terry, good luck. I hope the trend continues there. Stephen, are there cases of other non-celiac autoimmune disease where gluten-free might make sense?
By far, as your caller just mentioned, thyroid is by far the most common of the other diseases, and really the only one that seems to come up a lot when people are talking about other diseases other than celiac disease that gluten might affect.
So, Stephen, in our last couple of minutes, let's talk about the alternative to an increasingly gluten-free world. You look at, and you've touched on here today, artisan breads as alternatives, better processes, that sort of thing. What would a happy wheat-positive world look like for us?
Good question. A wheat-positive world would look like a world in which people are enjoying eating whole wheat without thinking that it tastes like roofing material. Because, to quote the late Robin Williams, because a lot of people when they grew up, including myself to some degree, always associated whole wheat with something that was good for us but really tasted lousy. And what's happened is that it's 100% whole wheat has really sort of had a renovation. It's being now made by really good bakers, including some smaller industrial bakers who are turning out good 100% whole wheat pasta and so forth, things that really didn't register at all in the Epicurean scale in the past. So I would urge your listeners to check things out. Whole Foods makes its own private label whole wheat pastas now, and I think you find them interesting. There are companies like Community Grains, by the way, all listed as resources in the back of my book, along with a homemade sourdough recipe for the bread that I've been making now for 2 years, which for some bizarre reason has led to about 10 pounds of weight loss for me and about 5 pounds for my wife.
Wow.
So it's gone in the opposite direction from what people might think. I think you really don't want to give up whole wheat, you know, in your diet unless you can find a substitute that really fulfills the same, you know, nutritive agenda. So I would, not try to toss it out because there's really nothing else I don't think that substitutes for it clearly. And it's something to keep in mind, of course, is that we've been eating wheat for over 10,000 years, and we've evolved pretty well.
Stephen, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
That was Stephen Yaffa, author of Grain of Truth, The Real Case for and Against Wheat and Gluten.